This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Kane, is one of South Africa's leading actors. During the apartheid era, he was a member of the Serpent Players, which included the white playwright Ethel Fugard. This group violated the law simply by being integrated. The group is most famous for its productions of two Fugard plays, Sizwe Bonsway is Dead and The Island, about the prison Robben Island. Kane won a 1975 Tony Award for his performance on Broadway in Sizwe Bonsway is Dead. Today he directs the Market Theater in Johannesburg. Now he's starring in a production of a play he wrote about post-apartheid South Africa called Nothing But the Truth. It's being performed at Lincoln Center until January 18th. The play looks at truth, lies, and reconciliation by focusing on two brothers. Kane plays Sipo, a librarian nearing retirement who was overshadowed by his younger brother Temba, a famous anti-apartheid activist who had lived in exile in London. As the play opens, Sipo is at the funeral of his younger brother, whose ashes have been returned for burial in South Africa. Here's Kane performing an excerpt of the play. Sipo, his character, is the assistant chief librarian who had always wanted to be promoted to chief.
So, you win again, Temba. I'm still dull. Nothing good is for me. I'm still at the library, and I'm not even the chief librarian, and will never be. If this country was free, I used to say to myself, if we had a black government, I would be the chief librarian. I watched the release of Nelson Mandela on television, and I said to myself, my time has come. I was 57 years old when I voted for the first time in my life in 1994. I made Nelson Mandela the first democratically elected president of this country. I was 62 years old when I voted again in 1999. No one said to me I was too old. How come I'm not too old to put them in power and suddenly I'm too old to be empowered?
John Kane told me he created this character to celebrate the unknown citizens who served in South Africa without reward.
Those who were in the marches, but were not in the front row, so you never see their picture. Those who were part of the protest, but they were just one of the thousands. Those who stood 5 hours on the queue in 1994 on the 27th of April, waiting to vote to give birth to South Africa's new democracy, but you never hear about their names. You didn't see them in the media. CNN and television didn't have their faces. So Sipho, the character who stays, is an ordinary South African. Unfortunately, things don't turn out his way, because at the time that he's due for promotion, he's already 63 years old. The brother who left is Temba. He was a member of the movement within South Africa, a political activist, a firebrand, an orator, loved by everybody, and of course, as all human beings who are in leadership, has a little flaws like everybody else is human. He did like the ladies a little, and that didn't make him very popular in certain areas. And as the story unfolds, you will then realize that even his own brother was not spared as a victim in his younger brother's philanderings.
Which brother do you play?
I play the older brother.
Why did you choose that brother for yourself?
I wrote the play from a point of the older brother, because when I started writing, I wanted to pay tribute to my brother, Olile, who was a poet. He was shot in 1985 at a funeral of a 9-year-old girl who was hit by a tear gas canister. At that funeral during the 80s, we used to use the funerals as political rallies to mobilize the people to rise against apartheid, to get the people not to give up hope, to continue the fight for the liberation of South Africa. So funerals were quite important platforms to be used by political activists. So the police came, 10,000 people attended this funeral. Within 2 minutes, hell broke loose. There was pandemonium, shots were ringing, tear gas all over the place. In fact, at that funeral, something for the first time happened. Shots rang also from the crowd, because ordinarily the police or the soldiers will shoot and people will run away. This time fire was returned, which marked the presence of the insurgents or liberation forces within South Africa. So at the end of that, four bodies lay on the ground, and only one of them had a name, Xolile, John Kani's brother. The others were just unknown three black youths. So in 1996, when the Truth and Reconciliation hearings came to my town, everybody wanted to know if we were going to go to these hearings to find out who killed my brother and why. My mother said no.
Why?
She said, no, I have been watching the television and listening to the radio. So many elderly people like me have been telling their story. I feel my story has been told. I don't think it's necessary for us to go there, and it's not going to bring my son back. My mother was a matriarch and a very powerful woman, so there's nothing we could do. We all agreed, Mom's right. But in me, there was no closure. In me, there was still bitterness and anger. In me, there was still that wanting some kind of revenge. I just didn't know what kind of revenge, but I did want something. And writing the play was, for me, trying to deal with that, to bring closure. Because every time I tried to think about my brother, I always thought, oh, he would have published a lot of poems now. Oh, he should be doing this now. Or he could be married with four children and successful. Or he could be overseas now. These are the things he should be doing. I could never see him in my mind resting. So after writing the play in the year 2001, completed it early 2002, that first performance was cathartic. That first performance was therapy. I mean, every ounce of my body heaved and gave in. At the end of it, with the audiences, with a thunderous applause, I mean, there were tears in my eyes. And I felt so good, so relieved, so the weight taken off my shoulders. I went home, visited his grave, and I stood there and just thanked him. And as from that day, I now remember my brother with fondness, with great pride of the price he paid so that I could be not only a free citizen of South Africa, but a free citizen of the world.
Were you at the funeral that he was shot at?
No, I wasn't, because I had just come back from England, and I called him that I wanted to talk to him.
From living there or just from touring there?
From touring and performing.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been at the funeral if I had been at home quite longer. So I just arrived. So he just told me that he won't be long. They're just going to do a couple of his poems. And there were a group, you know, of young poets. Go to the funeral and then we'll talk later.
And how did you find out the news?
Two young boys, aged 8 and 11, walked in and said, "Excuse me, are you Uncle John Kani?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you know Xolile Kani?" I said, "Yes." He says, "He's been shot at the funeral in Mqandi Street." So I just got in the car, drove like a madman, got there. There were just a few people wandering, and there was nothing. But you could see the chaos around, and they still smell the tear gas. And I asked, and people said the police took all the bodies and drove away with them in an ambulance. So I started the search for my brother, because I still had the hope perhaps he was still alive. I went to the local hospitals, clinics, police station, and after 7 hours, I finally got a tip from a young man. So I finally went to the police mortuary, and I saw his body. He was shot 3 times in his stomach. With a shotgun, the district surgeon said that he was shot at a close range of less than 2 or 3 meters. That's about 6 or 9 feet away from him.
Did the police deny that they shot him?
The police said there were a lot of young people attacking them with stones, with bullets, with everything. And they opened fire to defend their lives. So they would not know whether he in particular was one of those people they shot. Even the magistrate or the judge said the police acted under extreme provocation, and none of them could be individually or even collectively held responsible for the death of my brother. So it's almost appeared that no one shot him, but he's dead.
Did you and your brother have strong disagreements about what type of activism was the most potent anti-apartheid activism?
Like me and my eldest brother, who spent 5 years on Robben Island, I saw him as a radical. He was more concerned and worried about me. He felt that perhaps I wasn't as strong as he was. He also felt that I was a little reckless, because I would often shoot my mouth. And my association, of course, with people like Athol Fugard and the media and going abroad, he said, you've got to be more careful. You've got to be more careful. You know, the white people will be protected, but you are unprotected. So my brother was more Pan-Africanist. He was a member of the African Writers Association, which was an organization which wasn't allowing white writers to be members. So it was almost like for Africans only. He always queried relationship with white people, saying that it was diluting the strength of the struggle. It's creating an impression that there are a lot of white people who were part of the struggle for the liberation of South Africa, which was true. But this was a tease between me and him when we would sit down and discuss what I would really want to do with him, politics. But it was a mild joke between the two of us. Come on, you've got to come in the strength of the struggle. You can't carry these whites with you.
Well, the fact that you worked with white and black actors and playwrights is exactly what made that troupe like so unique. You know, the most notable of the white people in the troupe was Athol Fugard, the now
yes.
famous playwright. So this was a very unique company in South Africa, a very important one. So I imagine you felt very strongly about the importance of having this group that was comprised of black and white people.
No, actually, there was one member who was white.
Oh, it was just Athol Fugard. Oh.
Yes, the rest of the group was black.
Oh.
Or from New Brighton, my township. Only Athol was the member. In fact, we went to Athol in 1961 to ask him to join the group, because we had heard about his work. We had heard about his involvement with black theater makers in Johannesburg. Then he moved back to settle in his home, which is in Port Elizabeth. Then we went to speak to him, and he agreed to join the group. It was called the Serpent Players. Ask me now why we were serpents. I still don't know where we got the name, why we couldn't have had an African name. But I joined the group later, and Athol was already a member. Athol was directing most of the works we were doing, and also very integral and crucial to the process of improvisation and workshopping, which we called experiment in playmaking. We knew we had something to say. If we said it our way, it would have been a political statement. He had the ability to clothe this truth we wanted to say in a dramatic form, which was part of entertainment and informing and educating our audience that evening.
Did he, in a way, offer protection for the members of the group, too, since it might have been more difficult to attack the group with a white member in it than if the group was only comprised of black performers and writers? The authorities would have been able to probably get away with it easier.
Oh, no. He was in a more precarious position because he was white.
He was in a more precarious position?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, because he was seen as his government as a traitor,
oh.
a sellout to his own nation. He was seen as a communist. And what he was doing, working with us, with such a political and a militant group of blacks, was treason on his side. But he was more ostracized by the white media, by the white community, and by the white police force, which was making sure that any element of resistance was eliminated and obliterated. So I used to say to him, at least I could go back to my community that is proud of what I'm doing. You go back to your community that is looking at you as a sellout.
What's the worst thing that happened to you that, you know, that the government did to you as a result of your theatrical work?
Well, in 1975, we won the Tony Awards for Best Actor, me and Winston Jonah. We went back to South Africa.
This was for Sizwe Banzwe Is Dead?
For Sizwe Banzwe Is Dead and The Island. We went back to South Africa. Nobody even knew we'd won that because there was nothing in the media except perhaps for one local newspaper that ran one paragraph saying two black actors win prestigious award in America. End of it. So we started again the tour of South Africa to play in the rural communities, which we felt that they had not had the opportunity to see these plays, both The Island and Sizwe Banzwe Is Dead. We went to this small town in Butterworth, and we performed at the town hall, and the audience was mixed. I mean, we were breaking the law left, right, and center. And during the performance, we noticed that some strange-looking men were blocking the exits, and they were standing. And at the end of the play, both Winston and I, as we were bowing for the curtain call, were arrested and taken off the stage, Winston into another car, driven another 150 miles east. I was into another car, driving another 200 miles north. We met each other 23 days later. We were both detained in solitary confinement. And we met again on the 15th day, where he was leaving the interrogation where they brought in him to interrogate him. And I walked in, and I was also constantly being interrogated. I mean, the charges were furthering the aims of communism. Charges were inciting people to public violence. Charges were furthering the aims of the African National Congress, a banned organization, and promoting hatred among races. And you just, they went on and on and on. And none of them simply said for doing a play.
Because the real crimes here for the South African government was that you were doing a play that criticized the government, and you also had a mixed audience, and that was illegal too, right? Yeah,
that was illegal. Yes, mm-hmm. But finally, after 23, I think it was about on the 18th day, I got a piece of paper under the door of my cell, and it was so rolled, so tiny, that it took me about 5 to 10 minutes gently to open it without tearing it up. And then I saw it was the a local newspaper saying, Ghani and John are still in detention. Massive demonstrations in New York, London, Paris, Australia, Sydney. Oh, my. I celebrated that evening. I felt so good because I knew now nothing can happen to me. The world knows I'm here. So they can't kill me now. So at least I could sleep.
Do you think that they might have killed you had there not been demonstrations?
Many people disappeared. Many people disappeared. You picked up and get detained, and when people inquire, the police would tell them, no, this person was released 4 days ago. We don't know where this person is. And that's part of the pain of the truth and reconciliation. Because it was those people who were claimed to have been released that the security police were confessing of having killed them, actually, and buried them or burned their bodies. We had known a very good friend of mine, Mobs Qikhana, went to town just to go and buy a few things, and I never saw him again. And I've never heard of him since, even now. The Pepco tree, which is three wonderful activists in my own town, were told to go and meet a friend of theirs at the airport. Sipho Hashe and Godolozi and the others and Galela, and they disappeared. And during the Truth and Reconciliation, the police confessed having intercepted the car on the way to the airport, took them to an old farm, interrogated them, beat them to death, and burnt their bodies. So it was a common fear that if you are detained, you could disappear.
From what you're saying about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I would gather that you think their efforts were good efforts, and that it was important to have such a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Absolutely. I am 110% in support of the Truth and Reconciliation and amnesty.
Even though it gives amnesty to the people who confess?
Even if it gives the amnesty to the people who confess, even if to those who did not confess,
mm-hmm.
we had to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest prize that we got out of this struggle was the freedom of our people, the democracy, and the land that South Africa belongs to all of us. That, for me, is the biggest and noblest prize. But in the play, I examined that reconciliation in the family context, where because South Africa was not only between black and white, it was also between white and white, it was also between black and black.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that we also needed reconciliation within family, between black and black. And that's why Nothing But the Truth deals between two brothers, you know, who are part of the struggle, but played different roles.
How did you start acting? I imagine as a black South African, and you weren't exposed to a lot of theater when you were growing up.
Oh, no, there has been a lot of township theater from the 1834s, stories about our lives, great kings, township life. There's been a lot of it, but not in the kind of theater houses that were only in the white suburbs or white towns of South Africa.
Right.
And there was also the movie industry, which we call the cinema and the bioscope, where we saw all the great movies of the Indians being chased by John Wayne, Roy Rogers. We went to the movies and walked out very angry that the Indians lost all the time, irrespective of how many they were. We saw the war movies and then saw the karate, the kung fu movies and all those things. But at school, there was a wonderful teacher, English teacher, who was an aspiring dramatist who used us to dramatize our novels, short stories, poetry, and we did a lot of Shakespeare because it was prescribed work for us to do at school. And it was during those days that the interest in theater grew stronger and stronger and stronger. And then when I left school trying to find a career, I went to work at Ford Motor Company, which was an American company at the assembly plant, assembling engines. And that's where the experience is in Sizwe Banzi Is Dead, of the visit of Mr. Henry Ford in 1965 to South Africa, who never saw us at all. And though we were told that he was a very important person, but he never saw us at all. And all those things. So when I heard about this group called the Serpent Players, I went to check them out. And they were doing a play called Antigone by Sophocles. And I walked in and I saw this white person. I thought, whoops, this is dangerous. We're going to be in trouble here. I didn't know the group had a white member. And I was very nervous about any time the police would come in, we'd be in trouble here. But what Arthur was saying about this play, Antigone, was Antigone right to break the law? Was Antigone right to defy the state? Was Antigone right to do what is right in her heart and in the eyes of God, irrespective of the fact that the state had banned the burial of her own brother? That, for me, proved that the marriage between art and politics in the South African context would last for a very long time.
Now that apartheid is over, are you ever in the position of seeing people in the theater or on the street or at dinners and receptions who you know had worked against you during the apartheid years, either worked against you in the theater or worked as police or in any other, you know, capacity where you knew that you had been one of their targets?
Yes, of course. There was a particular person in my town in Port Elizabeth, New Brighton, who made me and Winston Jonner his personal responsibility. He was a lieutenant warrant officer of the special branch. Every time Winston and I returned from a trip abroad, he would come and visit and annoy us with asking all these 900 silly questions. Who did you meet? Who did you do this? Always kept saying, South Africa will never, never change. This is a God-created situation. They were the chosen people, not the Jews, and that South Africa was their country. And we didn't have the brains to become a free people or even to think we could govern. and all those things, you know, the terrible things he used to say. And I used to think that one day, if this country is free, I'll find him and I will make sure he also spends a day or two in detention, then just to make him feel, you know, how he treated us. In 1994, when we voted and we won, and Mandela was inaugurated as the first president, democratically elected, it was so strange. I really just wanted to see him, to see this man and say, hello, how are you? By the way, we were right, you were wrong. That's all I wanted to say.
Did you ever get to do that?
No, he died because he was quite elderly. And I have no feeling, really, I mean, towards him. I'm just laughing because he was stupid. You can't turn the tide of freedom. You can't. The people who fight for freedom will be free. They've got God on their side. They've got time on their side. They've got the truth on their side. It doesn't matter how strong the enemy is. It's only delaying the inevitable.
Sometimes authoritarian governments, repressive governments, give this kind of extra special power and mystique to the arts, to literature, to theater, to music, by suppressing it. And, you know, many writers and other artists have noted that sometimes their art has a lot more power when they're working under the repressive government. And then when the repression ends, sometimes people don't care that much about the art. And that power that the underground novel had or that the band play had, you know, is kind of dissipated. I'm wondering if you found something similar, that the power of theater wasn't quite as powerful once there was freedom.
Yes, of course. We, as I always say, 1994 and democracy crash landed on us. We were very famous because we were in the era of protest theater, mm-hmm. and protest art. Writers, sculptors, poets, you know, musicians, artists, all of us, you know, we spoke about the suffering of the human being, the inhumanity of men to men. And in 1994, South Africa became a democracy. We used to write plays demanding the release of Nelson Mandela. He was president. We used to write plays attacking the state. Now it was our state. We used to write plays attacking the vicious laws of a government. Now it was our government. Our society was changing right around us, and we were in the midst of that change. From 1994, 95, 96, there was this silence, this confusion, this state of transition, where we did not know what to write about, what to say. The stories we wanted to tell were still straddling the past and were part of the pain of the past. But we needed to understand that past in order to deal with the present and may even venture to look at what the future holds for us. Even our audiences who used to support that kind of work, especially in the theater that I run, the Market Theater in Johannesburg, our audiences dropped to almost 10%. And every play we were putting on was not drawing an audience. And we had to hold conferences and symposiums and discuss where the new South African work is must go or must come from, where these voices are. People just began, those that had resources and money, mostly white producers, brought in new plays from abroad, new acts and musicians from Michael Jackson to Janet Jackson to Tom Jones to Whitney Houston to Pavarotti to the Lord of the Dance, to everything they can bring in that sort of filled in the gap of uncertainty. But by 1997, a new sort of voice began to emerge. We began to find our feet. We began to identify what the stories we now telling are about. And Nothing But the Truth is one of those major breakthroughs into what South African theater voice is now.
I'm wondering what your older brother, your brother who was a member of the ANC and who spent 5 years in Robben Island prison, what is he doing now?
Oh, he's at home, he's retired, he was a counselor in Port Elizabeth, and now he's doing a small business for himself, and he is happy. But in the strangest thing, we discuss a lot of things, but never those 5 years. I don't know why. Every time I try to make him talk about what happened, He says, it was tough, but we made it. He never gets into detail in telling me what happened. So we have a fantastic relationship. He's happy and he's doing very well.
It sounds like a lot of people who return from war and don't want to talk about what happened there.
Yes, indeed. I mean, you want to know, like, on a day-to-day, I want the 5 years times 365. I want to know.
You want it all.
He never allows us to talk about it. He always changes the subject, and I leave him alone. Now I've known that. I've heard stories and pieces there and there, and we put them together in my mind. I know it was tough for him. It was tough for Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, and all the great brothers and sisters, of course, were kept in other prisons in South Africa. But it's not a secret they're keeping, but they just feel that to know that they suffered for what we are enjoying and we all went through the struggle is good enough to give us the hope for tomorrow.
Do you feel like you'll ever be at the point where you want to, you know, do like a musical comedy?
I wanted to do No, No, Nanette all my life. I don't know what it is about.
Why No, No, Nanette?
I don't know. I've always used that line, No, No, Nanette. I'd love to be in a farce, a comedy, where I rush on stage and the blood boils and the audience is standing and I'm tapping and I'm running out backstage and saying, I don't know what it is about, but I'm having a good time. I have chosen as a storyteller this kind of story, which is part of my existence. I did do a movie 4 years ago called Soweto Green, which was a comedy, a great, great farce of a South African who lived in L.A., studied botany and zoology, comes back just after 1994, people welcoming that the politician is back, and yet he's just a botanist. He wants to plant trees in Soweto to fight pollution, the air pollution. People are crazy. They say, no, no, we want you to lead us to the freedom to be part of the parliament. He says, no, I studied in L.A. I want to be a botanist, a zoologist. I want to fight the ozone layer. So it was such a farce. Well, and it was an incredible performance. It was a hit in South Africa. It ran for a long time.
I thought of Sizwe Banzwe is dead as being comedic. Because it was about, in part, the absurdity of apartheid.
Exactly. I mean, the most important ingredient in our work during the days of apartheid was humor. We knew that without humor, we called our people to a political meeting. With humor, we're calling them to witness and be part of an event, a journey, and we're going to have a good time tonight, but we're going to learn and hear about things that are important. Humor is that, it's therapy. I come from a long line of storytellers. My grandfather had three wives and could not spell polygamy. And I used to go to each grandmother, and the stories would make us laugh. But at the end of the stories, we learned a very good lesson about life.
You had been, and I'm not sure if you still are, the curator or chair of the Apartheid Museum?
Yes, I am the chair of the Apartheid Museum and part of the founder of the group of people who came together with the concept of creating a monument, some memory where the younger generation may forget. It's now the second most important place to visit in South Africa after Robben Island is the Apartheid Museum in Johannesburg, which is an experiential journey which begins in 1948 with the rise of white nationalism and ends at the inauguration of Thabo Mbeki and still has little indications of where the country is going today.
Is there any part of you that would like to do a Hollywood movie or two?
Yes, I do when I get the opportunity. I do. About 2 or 3 years ago, I did The Ghost and the Darkness with Michael Douglas and Val Kilmer. And I did another one called The Final Solution, which is a South African movie. And there are movies in the pipeline that I'm thinking about and talking, people are talking about. But I'd love to, my agent being the William Morris Agency, very good friend of mine, Samuel Leaf, always says, do you think I should get you a Hollywood big movie? I said, yes, so that I could make the money and then be able to have time to write the plays.
Now that apartheid has been over for about a decade, and you can theoretically live any place you want to in South Africa, what kind of neighborhood are you living in?
The economics are still prohibitive. You have about nearly 38 to 40 million black people who lived in sub-economic conditions. Not all of them are now able, within 10 years, to make enough money to move uptown or move to the east side or move to the suburbs, where houses are still in prices themselves are beyond their ability and capability. Well, we who at least can afford are living in an ordinary suburb, which is in town, closer to my work and closer to the schools where the kids are. These are the kinds of excuses of moving up we give ourselves because we now have money to buy a house in the so-called former white areas. We say, it's closer to the school. It's closer to my work. It's got closer to wonderful facilities around it. Shut up and say, I have money to buy a better house. And that's it.
You almost feel like you have to apologize for it.
You do, because you leave your own community and you know that the living conditions where you are going are much, much, much better than where you were. And you don't want to lose contact with where you came from, nor from your people. But you have to accept the upward mobility. It's part of the economy, the economics of the country and the way we live. But you always feel like you need to explain yourself.
Do you have any children?
Yes, I have 8 children.
Are any of them under 10, or have any of them grown up only in the post-apartheid era?
The last two, Anati was born in 1991, Akum was born in 1994.
Is that amazing to you that they will have never known that system?
I can tell you now, the others that were born in the 80s were now at universities and are questioning why we allowed it to happen for so long. They're almost like saying, come on, Dad, you mean you couldn't do that? Why? Why didn't you just tell them to get off? You're going to do it. They don't understand.
Yeah.
And the younger ones who had been with me with their mother just now, they don't know anything about it. And they're just looking at you as if it's once upon a time. When I'm trying to tell them, they say, here we go again. He's going to tell us that they were never used to eat here. They never used to do that. They never used to go there. They never used to be allowed there. Please, Daddy, can we get on with it? We're here now. So you think places like the Apartheid Museum and, of course, the tradition of storytelling, which is so African, still continues, though it's not as strong as it was, where parents hand over the history orally to the younger ones. We still do that. Whether they're listening or not, we tell them what happened.
John Carney, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Carney directs the Market Theater in Johannesburg. He's now starring in a production of his own play, Nothing But the Truth. Its run at Lincoln Center continues through Sunday.